What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Over the weekend, we continued to see the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases rise in Vermont. The most up-to-date information from the health department as of today is 256 confirmed cases, 12 deaths. As we've begun to do on Mondays of late, we're going to get a health update in this first hour of Vermont Edition today and a chance for you to ask medical professionals the questions that are preoccupying you about the illness. We'll be joined in a few minutes by Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine, but joining us as well for this hour and here with us now is Dr. Louis Dandoran, Director of Emergency Medicine at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. Dr. Dandoran, thank you very much for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Your hospital announced that a staff member has been confirmed to have COVID-19. What can you tell us about what impact that has had on hospital operations?
Not much impact for that that particular case because we have already been preparing, and our processes had already been very good. And in that particular case, after investigating, there was not much risk for exposure to other staff members, and we were able to continue our normal operations from there.
You must be preparing for people who are seeing patients regularly, who are working in ICUs, for example, to actually contract the illness.
Absolutely. We've made a lot of preparations for that, yes.
What happens in those cases? I mean, there's that sort of cascading effect of people who may be ill and need to stay home, then people who may need to be quarantined. At what, you know, how do you sort of have enough to continue operations as you project out what this could look like?
So in preparing for an influx of patients that could potentially have the infection, we had already redesigned our systems to accept patients that are higher probability for having the infection versus patients that are more for our normal population without the risk of infection. And we had to carefully, at the very start of the encounter with patients as they come in either by ambulance or by walk-in, and either as an ambulatory patient seeing a primary care provider or as a patient that's coming to the emergency department, able to sort these patients so that we reduce the risk to staff already by the pre-screening and directing them to a place that's safer to be evaluated. So, for example, we have an acute respiratory clinic in our primary care clinic so that patients are directed towards there if they have any respiratory symptoms. And then in that workflow, we have added precautions. We've got universal precautions for all patient encounters, but we're able to take additional precautions by identifying people right at the door.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, if there are additional precautions now for all patient encounters. I haven't heard about it happening in Vermont, but I have heard in other places that there have been encounters with a patient who didn't know, for example, that they had COVID-19. It was actually diagnosed later on and came in for a totally separate illness or came in to deliver a baby.
Yes, absolutely. That's a risk, and we've discussed this with staff, and it's a constant process of educating folks of what we can do, even without wearing the protective equipment, even without wearing an N95 or surgical masks. There are things that we can do in our behavior that prevents the or reduces the risk of transmitting the infection, and that's distancing, which is out there for everyone, but can be practiced in a healthcare setting as well. If a healthcare provider removes themselves at a distance from the patient, still respectfully able to interview the patient, but at a distance, reducing the risk. And then when you have the closer encounter with the patient, such as a physical exam, either you can use some protective equipment at that point, or by making the encounter much shorter than we would normally possibly you move in. You do the work that you need to do up close, and then you move back. And the amount of time that you spend in close proximity, if it's reduced, greatly reduces the chance of transmission as well. So just those types of simple actions help prevent the spread of infection.
Do you currently have enough personal protective equipment for all of your staff members who are interacting with patients?
At this juncture, yes.
And how much do you think you might need in the future? Are you confident that you'll be able to sort of ride the surge with the adequate amount of PPE?
Well, as this epidemic develops, you know, it's hard to tell where the peak will be at this point, since we're still on a steep rise in the number of infections. And so are we going to have enough PPE? It's very hard to predict. And I would say, from my personal opinion, currently, that we will not.
That must be a worry.
It is.
We're talking with Dr. Lewis Dandurand, Director of Emergency Medicine at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. And let's bring Dr. Mark Levine into the conversation. He's Vermont's Health Commissioner. Dr. Levine, thank you for running from the press conference and joining us.
Hi, Jay.
So we heard you announce in the governor's press conference today the latest numbers, 256 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Vermont, 21 new cases since yesterday, and 12 deaths. What can you tell us about the fatalities? I think a lot of people are worried about people who are dying.
As am I, absolutely. It seems like a relatively large number of deaths for such a small state. But it is what it is. And as you know, we have a changing demographic in Vermont, and we are now competing with Maine and New Hampshire, all within the top three for the oldest states in the country. And sometimes we come out second, sometimes we come out third, but we're clearly an aging state. And the deaths actually reveal that. Of the deaths, the majority of them are higher than age 70, for sure, and many are actually in the high 80s and 90s. So there is an immune compromise that comes about just from aging alone, and there's also immune-compromising diseases that may accompany you as you get to that stage in life. And we know that 7 of the deaths occurred related to the Burlington Health and Rehab Facility. No less tragic, though. Every individual's somebody's significant other, grandparent, sibling, what have you. But we do know that the goals of care for many of those individuals was not to have intensive care and be placed on ventilators and go to hospitals. So they are a different subset, but it does illustrate how absolutely tragic it can be when an infection is introduced into such a facility. Likewise, the deaths that occurred outside of that facility generally were hospitalized, but again, even all of the interventions that could be made in the hospital were not enough to combat the absolute lethal nature of this virus in the right population. Now, we do try to reassure the population that, thinking about nationwide and worldwide experience, the case fatality rate is in the 1% range, which is still rather high, comparing it to something like influenza, where it's 0.1%. but very low when you compare it to the previous coronavirus, which was SARS, which was about 10 or 15%, and MERS, which was 3 times that. But still, 1% is rather large. But you should remember that that's an average about all deaths. So people who are in their 40s, 50s, or younger, the case fatality rate is actually much lower than that. But if you're already in your 90s, the case fatality rate is over 10%. So it really is being a very selective virus in terms of who it's harming the most.
Well, let me bring some calls in here as we're having this conversation with Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont's Health Commissioner, and Dr. Lewis Dandurand, Director of Emergency Medicine at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. Let's go to Kathy, who's calling in from Linden. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jane.
Go right ahead.
Well, first of all, thanks to everybody for everything you're doing in this really difficult time. I have a 96-and-a-half-year-old mother in a long-term care facility, and I believe they are doing absolutely the best they can, but I feel like, is it not inevitable eventually for COVID to get into that facility? And what are the recommendations for staff currently? Should they be masking? If they don't have enough of the N95s, should we be encouraging homemade masks with education about cleaning, covering? Anyway, what are recommendations at this time?
Kathy, thanks for sharing your questions and, of course, your concern for your mother. Let me start with you, Dr. Levine. What kind of protocols are long-term care facilities and independent senior living facilities going to be implementing? What do they need to do? I mean, you were talking about our aging population, so what needs to be done across the board?
Right. So we at the Department of Health, along with the Centers for Disease Control and our Department for Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, have put out a number of health alert notifications and policy recommendations to long-term care facilities, which are a very, very broad and heterogeneous group of facilities, I might add. But to try to oversimplify, if I might, clearly visitation policies are first and foremost. So in the very, very beginning, it was trying to be common sense about the visitation policy. Now it's very much restrictive. And unless a loved one is literally at the end of life or had some other major complication, it's very restrictive regarding the opportunity to visit. Second thing is that we do know that, you know, employees and healthcare workers can unwittingly be vectors of condition like COVID. So we've recommended, of course, what everybody knows from common sense, that you do not come to work if you feel the least bit ill. But then on top of that, there are temperature checks twice per shift to make sure that we catch up with people early and understand that they may be coming ill and try to limit any interaction they would have with patients because they won't be allowed to work otherwise.
But should you be implementing sort of prophylactic mask use under the assumption that we're all supposed to be following, that we could all be carriers now before the onset of symptoms?
Right. So, you know, the bottom line on prophylactic masks is that if you yourself are ill, it will block some of the larger droplets from affecting anyone else. Generally, a mask wouldn't prevent you from getting ill if that's going to happen to you. It's not, the typical mask anyways, is not as protective as the kind that are used like N95s for healthcare personnel who are in direct patient care contact. So masks are clearly used when we know there's a problem in a place, and we try to make sure that they're adhered to at that point, but not in a preventive sense. And as you know, we've had an issue with just making sure that we have the appropriate personal protective equipment in large enough quantity and don't use them unnecessarily, if you will. And you heard at the press conference about the large shipment that's come in, so we'll be dissecting that and understanding exactly how many of what came in. But as Commissioner Sherling said, there literally were hundreds of thousands of various components of personal protective equipment.
Dr. Dandurand, what are you asking for and recommending at your hospital? Because, you know, we keep hearing some hospitals have been saying, sure, make homemade masks. Some people are wearing homemade masks. Some hospitals are saying this is, and some news reporting suggests that this is actually less than effective to have a homemade mask. So what are you suggesting for people who either want to help or are trying to figure out what they should do for themselves?
As far as the community goes, I think social distancing and
staying at home policies for people that are feeling ill are primary for one, because you know, the public has to help us out in this epidemic. Healthcare systems alone will not be able to manage this on their own. As far as specifically our needs, it's being managed by our incident command in terms of the number of masks and variety of PPE items that we have in stock, and the requests are being made through that entity. I can't give you more specifics about exactly which part of the equipment we might be shortest on, but we do manage it very closely.
Peter's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Peter. Go right ahead.
So my question is, if you have gotten the virus and have gotten well again, are you then immune to getting it a second time or passing it on?
Peter, thanks for the call. Dr. Levine, what do we know about that so far?
I wish we knew more. It's a great question. It's one of the ones that's most commonly asked. The World Health Organization has specialty expertise in this area as well, and their answer currently has been pretty much we don't know. We know that this virus is in the coronavirus family, and we humans actually commonly get other milder cold-like coronavirus infections. And there's not evidence that having had one of those once protects you for the rest of your life. And I think testimony to that is how often people get the common cold, even though it's not always a coronavirus that's causing it. So I wish I had a more scientifically based answer for you, but at the present time, we don't have confidence about that.
Do you have any sense? I mean, with the common cold, my understanding was that you may not have a lifetime immunity to that strain, but you might have a temporary immunity.
And that may well be true. And we know that the latest set of tests for coronavirus involve a blood sample. They're called a serologic test, which look for the formation of both acute and chronic antibodies against the virus. So it may be relatively easy in the near future for us on a large population basis to determine what percentage of the population has some immune status against this particular coronavirus. What it won't tell us, though, is the likelihood that you will or will not get infected again, and how might that play out in terms of the severity of the infection the next time around. It's going to take experience, because I have to remind everyone that the reason this is such a severe crisis worldwide is that this particular coronavirus has not infected humans before, to the best of our knowledge, and it came from an animal source, and we just don't know the experience of humans with this. It's all very new in the last several months.
Just a quick follow-up from Sean, who emails in to say, do you have any estimates on how many cases have recovered in Vermont?
I can't give him that just yet, because most of the cases are literally within the last several weeks. Even the CDC is not saying, like, if you have coronavirus and you want to go back to work, well, it has to be 7 days since the onset of your symptoms. You have to have 3 more days where you haven't had a fever or any other symptoms with it, because this isn't like a 2 or 3 day common cold for most people. It lasts quite a number of days. So it's going to be hard to answer that question this early in the game.
A question for you, Dr. Dandran, from William, who wrote in to say the coronavirus is making it difficult or impossible for some people with other conditions to receive the care they need. My wife was supposed to start a course of radiation for cancer at the hospital in Burlington in mid-March. Her initial appointment was put off for a month because of the coronavirus demands. It seems likely that things will be much worse by the time of her new appointment. There must be many people who are already in treatment or awaiting treatment for conditions that predate the coronavirus panic who are now left exposed. This does not seem right. What is being done to assure that such people will get the care they need? Could you talk about how that's working at your hospital, Dr. Dandrian?
Yes, absolutely. And I think most medical organizations are probably going through a similar process of assuring that there's still access to folks with for medical conditions that have predated this epidemic. And that's if we put it in terms of a unit or an area that is not infected or has patients that have very low risk, in areas where patients have more a likelihood of being infected, and then allowing a corridor through our systems to allow patients to be seen for their other conditions. And we have done a lot of preparation just for that, and really trying very hard to keep those systems open. That's probably one of our primary goals.
So could you see patients who have been getting care at one hospital or even at one system being moved to another hospital to get the kind of care, like, for example, cancer care that is very urgent? You know, could they be moved around and still get the care that way?
I think as this epidemic develops further, some of these systems will develop as well. I think in that first phase of responding to the epidemic, we've kind of had to reorganize ourselves, and the access points are much more closely monitored. So I think for the access points being closely monitored, it's anxiety provoking for our patients that are coming in to be seen. So we've seen a decreased patient volume just from the initial part of this epidemic, but as the medical conditions that people have in the community have not changed, and they will need access. And as our systems develop, I think we'll need to accommodate those folks for sure. It's just because it's an ongoing evolving situation. I think we'll see differences, and will patients then access care through a different facility that's now more accessible for this particular condition? That could be. It's hard to predict at this point.
Let's go to Nancy in Barnett. Hi, Nancy. Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. Take it off speaker. Hi, I'm calling because 2 weeks ago, my son, who lives closer to Montpelier, came down with what he's pretty sure was the COVID virus. Got very tired at work, had to come home. Headache that progressed to a sore throat, fever, called the hospital. They said, don't come in. We can't give you a test. You're too young. He's 33. Stay home and treat your symptoms. And, you know, they had to save the test for older people with pre-existing conditions. So he did. Unfortunately, very painful, burning lungs and so on. But he was okay. 48 hours later, he felt better. His girlfriend nursed him through it. She has not gotten any symptoms. This was 2 weeks ago that it all happened. And so they've never been tested. He called the CDC, and they said, you know, a week after the symptoms started and what you just said, he could go back to work. So
Nancy,
all,
are you wondering if he should get tested now?
Yes.
Oh, good. So, Dr. Levine, what about that? We know that on Friday you were talking about the fact that Vermont is planning to significantly expand its testing and to now include people who have moderate to mild symptoms of COVID-19. So let's first answer Nancy's question and then talk a little bit more about this testing. Should her son, who was symptomatic 2 weeks ago, get a test?
Yeah, at this point in time, I would say no. Because the test might not show anything at this point in time. If we did that serologic test, which is not part of our testing regimen right now, we might actually find that he had antibodies. So at some future time, that might become important. But the people that we would like to test right now would be those who are currently not previously symptomatic, to give us a much more accurate view of what's going on in our population right now, and to be able to really isolate people appropriately because they're positive, and then do the contact tracing of all the people that they were in contact with so that those people could be quarantined, knowing that they may never show infection, but there's a possibility that they may actually become infected over that period of time, which is the 14-day period.
So how mild is mild? I mean, we keep hearing about what the symptoms are if you have a case of, you know, what develops as a moderate to severe case where you have a fever, a dry cough, it can expand to a shortness of breath and then some pretty severe breathing issues and pneumonia. But for the people who are wondering, well, you know, I hear that people sometimes don't get any symptoms or they get mild symptoms that just seem like a mild flu or even like a cold. How in the world should you know what's mild enough and severe enough to go get tested with?
Yeah, so you're sort of describing it's in the eyes of the beholder. I haven't seen a lot of people with COVID-19 who said that they felt hardly abnormal. Mm-hmm. You know, most people have a little bit more dramatic story about some of their symptoms. But we really do want to know the spectrum of what is out there. And so I would submit that, you know, if you've had a very mild cough with a low-grade temperature, that probably qualifies for mild, and we wouldn't want you to not avail yourself of testing if you're, if in the clinical judgment of your healthcare provider, that was something that they thought was important to do. Because really, we're trying to do, if I could give the big picture, two parallel strategies. Everybody knows about the stay home and stay safe. That's called a mitigation strategy. And frankly, that strategy is done in large populations when all the earlier strategies have not succeeded in preventing the spread of the virus. We know that this can be a very effective strategy, and that's why it's obviously continuing. But in parallel, we're using a strategy that other countries in the world, specifically some of the countries in Asia, use, which is called containment. And that's where you have widespread and accessible early testing of the population so that you can identify hotspots, you can identify parts of the population that harbor the virus, and by isolating and then quarantining their contacts, you can suppress the ability of the virus to spread from person to person in the whole population. So we're trying something in parallel, containment and mitigation at the same time, and we hope that together we'll do the so-called flattening of the curve that we've been talking about for some time now, knowing we won't stop the spread of the virus completely, but that will suppress the virus and preserve the capacity of the healthcare system to cope with any of the serious illness that might come.
Do you want kids to be tested in that case, considering that children often do, it seems like, have a very, very mild case? I mean, in terms of flattening the curve, would it make sense for children to be tested?
Right. Our counseling and our advice to the pediatric population, which, by the way, was formulated with pediatric experts, is to avoid testing in that population, except for the part of the population that may have a much more severe illness or that may have other medical factors at play in terms of concomitant illnesses or disabilities that would make it very important to know if it was COVID. So we really are much more emphasizing the adult population.
That's interesting to know. Thank you. Thank you for that update. And one more question on the testing before we come back to some of our listener questions. We know that the state of Vermont wants to expand the testing and has more testing capacity right now. But is there a sense that you're going to go hard on this, even if it sort of depletes your supply of available tests? Or do you expect to get a continual supply now? You said on Friday you are not relying on help from the federal government for testing supplies.
Yeah. So as we speak, we're really making sure that we have access to the supplies that we need. But we did in our initial statement, and we still stand by this, say that if the cost was that we actually would run out prematurely, we would still have benefited tremendously from the information we got on a public health surveillance standpoint, but more importantly to people on a illness standpoint, in that we would have been able to identify at a point in time where the significant illness is, and through really enhanced contact tracing, we're actually utilizing extra human resources in that endeavor. Through that, we would be able to have people more strongly adhere to the stay home, stay safe counseling that they're already getting, and actually quarantine themselves for the 14 days because they were at such high risk for contracting the virus. So we're prepared to run out if it actually came to that, but we'd like to actually continue this program as long as possible, and that's why we're still working in a number of arenas to make sure we have enough collection samples to process. We've done pretty well lately with the actual testing in the lab through our own public health labs, through the work of UVM, and through the work of private commercial labs. And we feel that in that arena, we're at less risk now than we were, say, a week ago. But as you know, in terms of the nationwide response, there have been critical shortages all across the spectrum, whether it's in collecting samples, whether it's in processing them, whether it's in PPE. And now we're starting to see some of those become improved, and we hope that that trend continues.
Dr. Dandurand, I understand that you're concerned about the waiting period for those test results, you know, that the fact that for some people, at least, it can take 2, 3, 4, or 5 days to get the test results back could really impact our ability to bend the curve?
Yes, absolutely. That's our experience currently in the practical practice is that we do have to wait several days for results. Even for an admitted patient, some admitted patients over the weekends, we're still waiting results on some patients. And there's a lot of factors that play into that in terms of the delivery of the sample to the state lab and then having it sourced out from there if needed, and then the timing of the run of the test. If we happen to catch it the same day, or if it's going to be run the next day, and there's also with priority labels. Sometimes, if the test is not labeled correctly as a priority, it may be put in the same run as the drive-by testing, which takes longer to result. So it does hamper our ability to respond to this accurately, since we may be a few days behind from the actual. Conditions in the field with our test results.
Dr. Dandurand, we were talking a little bit about testing and the how having to wait for test results can mean that there might be a proliferation of cases in the community that of people who don't know they're exposed or don't know that they might have the COVID-19 themselves. Do you have a sense, given that our number is 256 confirmed cases in the state as of this morning, do you have a sense of how many cases you think actually might be in the state?
It's hard to estimate. But just by nature of the illness, because it starts normally with a cough and some symptoms that might be milder and then progresses, generally people might wait a few days from the time that they start having symptoms to the time that they might present for a test. So we're already from the time that a person might be infectious to the time they get tested. And then if we're waiting a few more days for the test result, then we're looking potentially at up to a week out from the time that a person might be infectious to the time where they're confirmed to have the illness and able to act on it. Most people that are having symptoms, though, are self-quarantining. I think everybody understands the importance of that. So I think from that standpoint, we've gotten the message across. But once you are confirmed with a test, the next step really is the outreach to contacts of that person, see if there's clusters of infection around that area or whoever's involved with that person, finding out they might have symptoms and then reaching out to them to have them come in. But so we're delayed by potentially up to a week from making those contacts. So the numbers that we're seeing currently, infection in the state, I think reflect maybe numbers that might be 6 days behind the true epidemic or something of that nature, just estimating how this thing is playing out.
Given what we know about how the many people who have it may not ever be tested and may never have confirmed cases, you know, do you think it's a factor of 10 bigger than what we're testing for?
I would estimate in that range, maybe a little less than 10, but somewhere in that range. I can say from my own personal experience on some of our COVID positive patients that there's been clusters of infection within a family group, say, for example, and maybe one of those might present for additional testing because of our limitations in of recent. And so I would say maybe a factor of 5 to 10.
Mike's calling in from Charlotte. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Levine. Thank you for taking my call. And the question is, for persons who are older in that older age range or that have medical issues to put them at higher risk, once the stay-at-home order is lifted, what's the probability of someone in that encountering the COVID-19 virus when they go back out into the community? And is, you know, are there additional precautions that have to be taken in that regard?
Mike, thanks for the call. Yes, so Dr. Levine, for people who are older or immunocompromised, even once the general population has been given the okay, and we don't know when that will be, to either stop isolating or to be able to go to work, for example, should people in those categories of higher risk take any extra precautions? Are they still likely to be infected?
Yeah, you know, that's such a tough question. But I can tell you that the flattening of the curve and the suppressing of viral infection isn't the elimination of viral infection. And even when we look at other countries that have had experience prior to our countries, you know, that period of time goes on for quite a few months. And then you hope to see a dip and more of a disappearance of the virus. There are some models that reveal that even after a couple months, sometimes as long as 6 months, where the virus isn't really doing a lot, that you may then get another peak of activity of virus. Won't be as high as the one you were trying to prevent initially, but it will still involve some aspect of the population. So it's a real challenge if you're in one of the higher risk groups and trying to go back to normal life, so to speak, and evaluate your risk. Because, again, we're dealing with models predominantly, and hopefully we'll have a little more experience from places like China, Korea, et cetera, by the time we get to that point. And we'll learn a little bit from them and understand how safe they might be, because we certainly don't want to give people a false sense of assuredness that the storm is over and you can come out now. And I still think we'll have to be very, very careful about that.
Do you have any sense of where we are on the curve right now? I mean, we have been told to continue to expect pretty significant increases, but do you have any sense? The president last night said 2 weeks, we're going to see the surge. You know, the surge is going to hit in 2 weeks, and then we'll start to decline.
Right. And that, of course, is going to be different in every part of the country, because different parts of the country have more mature involvement of the virus infection in their population than others. We kind of think we're not early anymore, but we're certainly before the peak, so on the way in that direction, hopefully with not too steep of a curve. Whether the peak, you know, we're going to talk as a state later this week about some of the modeling that's been done and that's getting informed by the experience we've had, plus by any testing that goes on this week. But most people are thinking sometime in April, whether it's mid, late, unclear, we'll be getting to that peak level, but that we haven't reached it yet.
We got a note from Linda who says, we are Florida residents who usually spend summers at our vacation home in Vermont. We're scheduled to drive up next month, but I'm not sure that will be possible. We've been self-isolating for 3 weeks now, but are concerned about driving on the highways with no accommodations. And will we even be allowed in? Dr. Levine, given the governor's announcement today of, you know, asking people, if you do not have to come to Vermont, please don't. What should people like Linda expect and do?
And you said Linda is a Vermonter? Or?
Florida resident who spends the summers in Vermont. So it's part-time, you know, winters in Florida. Okay. What are the snowbirds supposed to do?
Yeah, so, you know, that's a challenging question, but the governor's answer was pretty clear that if you can avoid doing that traveling, avoid doing that traveling. If you are coming to Vermont, we will treat you like we would anybody coming from any higher risk population, whether it be China, Italy, or what have you, and insist on a two-week quarantine process just to be safe, if you will. And, of course, you should still be in the same social distancing situation that we're in right now. That would never change. But she would definitely have the two-week period. And I think she points out some really good points that most states now don't want their hotels to be open doors and welcoming, no matter if they're just on the way to Vermont or in Vermont. And it's also challenging even to access food on your trip now, except for drive-through windows at some fast food places. So it would be a challenge for her to do that trip at this point in time, period.
Dr. Dandurand, can I ask you about flu? I mean, we know that flu is a significant concern and you know, a significant concern in an elderly population like Vermont as well. Where are we now with flu? And, you know, are we starting to see that seasonal decline in numbers? Should people be concerned about that right now?
Yes, I think we're starting to see a decline in flu. We are also testing for RSV and finding some cases of RSV still circulating in the community. So that does confound the presentation of patients.
RSV is a respiratory virus?
Yes, a respiratory syncytial virus. That is mostly a concern in children. For their because it tends to affect younger children less than 1 year old, primarily as far as the need for respiratory support if they get this illness. But in adults, it tends to be milder and not cause as much a problem. But because our flu and RSV PCR test is combined, we're getting more RSV positive in adults than we did previously, but just from the nature of our testing. And we are still finding some RSV positive adults and children in our community.
Dr. Levine, how are you advising morticians to stay safe? And it's a morbid question, but, you know, one that certainly is of interest to them and to many people. You know, as we continue to see fatalities because of COVID-19, does the illness pose any risk to morticians in their postmortem clients?
Yeah, I wish I could give you up-to-date guidance on that. I'd have to actually look that up. I know that that question's come up, and I believe we've advised a lot of caution because they are appropriately concerned. But again, you know, the virus can only be viable for so long a time in a person who's deceased. But I think your question is a good one. I'd have to actually review the guidance that's out there. I would suspect the CDC has guidance on that.
Are you concerned that there could be a surge in fatalities that could overwhelm our capacity to deal with the dead, whether that's embalming and cremation or all of the things that go into, you know, dealing with what happens when there are a lot of fatalities?
Yeah, so I will speak broadly and not just for Vermont. This actually came up slightly at the press conference today. Every state is requesting refrigerated trailers, specifically with that rather grim outlook in mind, not knowing what the truth will be in the end, but just like every other aspect of surge planning, trying to plan for more worst-case scenarios and being prepared. So Vermont has also similarly been requesting refrigerated vans as well, for that purpose.
Do you have advice on the sort of human scale for people who are worried about what this might mean if they have a loved one who's died? And, you know, for 12 families, that's already the case. And for families who are dealing with the death of loved ones who have nothing to do with COVID-19, but now can't have a funeral or can't visit their family member who's died. You know, what advice and thoughts do you have for people in this really difficult time of grief?
Yeah, it is so challenging and so devastating. People wanting to even just be close to their loved ones while they're still alive but in terminal stages and often unable to do that. And then, as you point out, not having the traditional, really, what a funeral is really a celebration of life for mm-hmm. those who survive and a commemoration of the deceased. And not being able to have that in the traditional sense goes against every part of our sort of culture. The fact is, I've actually been able to witness virtual funerals, which sounds really a little bit out there. But again, people wanting to still, in a more immediate sense, pay their proper respects and honor the memory of a friend, family member, loved one, etc. Just like when everybody in the society is holding business differently, you know, in a more virtual sense. I would hate to see that happen for a prolonged period, and there have been plenty of funerals that have been put on hold and not occurred with the hope that they can occur in some future month. But my heart reaches out to those who are in those situations because it is so, so challenging for them through the entire aspect of the dying process and then after the death has occurred, because we usually think of a funeral as bringing some finality, even though we will forever remember, at the same time it brings some finality to a process that is helpful to the rest of the human beings who are still alive to get through. So very challenging. I think, you know, your comment speaks even more widely to the whole concept of all of our mental health collectively as a society, since social distancing is so anathema to the way we traditionally interact with each other as human beings. And our entire lives, whether it be social lives, work lives, the way we value our time and the way we value our productivity has changed so much. And so there's a lot of work going on now in the mental health community with ways to help us through this, if you will. And I think you've had some airtime to that topic previously.
Mm-hmm. We have, and you know, we only have a couple of seconds, but are you managing that for yourself, Dr. Levine?
I think I am, relatively so. In the rare moments when I actually like go to the supermarket or what have you, and when I'm not working, it's just so encouraging to me, the number of Vermonters who, with appropriate social distance, just thank me for what I'm doing, knowing, as I'm sure everyone does, that I don't have the power to stop this crisis, but we can try to do our best as a state in managing it and trying to help the most people together.
Well, I appreciate that and wish the best to you, Dr. Mark Levine, Vermont's health commissioner, and Dr. Louis Dandaran, director of emergency medicine at Northwestern Medical Center in St. Albans. Thanks very much to our guests today. I'm Jane Lindholm. Stay tuned for a second hour of Vermont Edition.